Hi, this is Tamsin Granger.
And this is Dan Abuhoff.
And here we are with Sadie Abuhoff for Tamsin and Dan Read the Paper on July 2nd, 2017. It's actually 4th of July weekend, which is probably why Sadie is here. Right, Sadie?
Yes.
All right, good to see you.
And Sadie's here in particular to report with us on what we saw last night, which was Hello, Dolly.
Yes, trying to keep ourselves entertained during the long weekends.
Well, more than that.
We trucked into the big city.
You're not giving us nearly enough credit. This is journalistic integrity. We had commented previously on the questionable casting of Bette Midler in Hello, Dolly. The uneven reviews, notwithstanding the universal acclaim by the theater world at the Tonys. And we went there to check out ourselves, the so-called understudy, Donna Murphy, who one of us represented would likely be superior to Bette Midler.
Right.
And we're here to give you the report. Sadie, what did you think of Hello, Dolly?
Well, first of all, I like that you research the fact that Bette Midler got questionable reviews by seeing her understudy. That's thorough.
Yes, well,
yeah. But I was surprised that I liked it as much as I did.
Yes, Sadie was dragged against her will to this play.
Well, it's a very old school play and old school music. So it's totally different than a lot of things on Broadway currently.
Right. It's not Hamilton.
It's not Hamilton, which, you know, nothing else is really Hamilton. But I am not that interested in the old, like, operatic, let's sing about the sunshine kind of musical. So I was surprised that I liked it.
Well, that's great. Let me just set the stage here for people so they understand it. Number one, it isn't an old school musical in the sense that it was 1964 when it swept the Tonys as the best musical, and then starring Carol Channing. The story is a story of a matchmaker named Dolly Levi, who is there making various matches and at the same time trying to follow through on her plan to wed herself to the richest guy in town, the town being Yonkers, the man being Horace Vandergelder. And, you know, comedy ensues. It is a farce, really, set to music.
Yeah, there's a lot of running around and mistaken identities and et cetera.
But it's funny.
And there's vaudeville type of
right. When you
stuff.
Say it's funny, say?
Yeah, it's really funny.
And it's funny?
And I mean, there is a scene where people are popping out of and into closets and under tables, and it really is old school, and you kind of laugh in spite of yourself.
And it's fun music. I mean, it is a high intensity, high energy, audience going crazy from the first moment, finger snapping musical. Is that fair enough, Sadie?
No, I don't think it's finger snapping.
All right, finger snapping. That was West Side Story. That was a mistake.
I think the music is good. I don't think it's like as fantastic as like some of the other top tier musicals, but
it's fair.
I'm not a huge fan of slapstick humor. I thought the dialogue was more funny than the actual running in and out of closets.
Yeah, okay, but it was funny.
Oh, yeah.
And the audience was with it, and you get swept away. You know, you talk about Sadie saying at the outset that she liked it more than she wanted. You know, we were sitting in a row where there was one gentleman who looked like the typical husband dragged to the theater type of guy in shackles. And I think, Tamsin, you can report on what you heard from him after the first few minutes.
Yes, he, you know, after one of the first couple songs, he said, "I think I like it. I didn't think I would like it, but I think I like it."
And you can't help it. You can't help but be swept away. It's a tremendous amount of fun. But as long as we're talking about who was sitting near us, who was sitting right in front of us, Sadie?
Bernadette Peters.
Yes, we discovered at intermission.
Yes.
We didn't notice her there, oddly enough, before intermission.
Right.
But when she came back, we saw her coming to her seat.
And she looks a lot better in person than I thought she would, to the point where I thought, oh, that looks like Bernadette Peters, but it looks like a younger version of Bernadette Peters. But then you realize it is Bernadette Peters, and she looks good.
So, of course, we're wondering why exactly she's there, and Dan has a theory.
Well, my theory is she might be the next Dolly. I mean, she's in the demographic.
Yeah.
She has a certain stature.
I was wondering that, too, because
I think
she fits that mold.
Yeah, she definitely does.
And her voice would be fun for those songs, just in the way that Carol Channing's voice was honed for the songs.
Yeah.
And to be honest, I think she was thinking quite seriously about that possibility. I mean, I felt by studying the back of her hairdo, the back of her head.
It was a formidable.
I am a great judge of the back of the head. Yeah. I can tell what people are thinking just by looking at the back of their head.
Well, you were,
I think she was.
You're making fun of her hair, but her hair is her signature.
I'm not making
fun
of her hair.
It always has to be the same.
I was impressed. It was extremely thick, vibrant, arranged head of hair.
All right, enough about the hair.
But here's what's interesting about her. I do agree with both of you. I think she fits the profile, but that takes us to the important issue, which is what is the profile? And we saw Donna Murphy. And Donna Murphy is a great Broadway actress, and she has the awards to prove it. Obviously, Bette Midler has been the star.
Yeah, you were downing Bette Midler.
After seeing the play, I understand how Bette Midler can be effective. And the reason is because there's so much comedy. And there's so many bits of business that you could see Bette Midler excelling at. So I am less down on the idea, even though I didn't see Bette Midler, of seeing Bette Midler in the show.
But now you should really see Bette Midler, because it'd be interesting to see, does she do the same bits?
Right.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of like talking to the audience and giving kind of funny looks, and that's kind of where Bette Midler excels.
Well,
she's really good at giving like a funny eye.
You know, I am glad you brought that up, because it's exactly what I was thinking, and this plays also into who might take the part later on. That's exactly what's going on, and that's often described as breaking the fourth wall. The idea about the performer looking out and communicating in a way that's out of character, as if the performer is dealing with the audience, and this is a vehicle for that. And what's interesting about that is that that's clearly the way Bettler must do it. There's no other way, right? You can see it. And the audience responds to that. Some people like it, some people don't. Carol Channing clearly did that in 1964, and the audience responded. Even Pearl Bailey, you can just imagine Pearl Bailey just looking out in the audience during the big Hello Dolly restaurant scene and saying, get me a chair, honey, I'm doing 8 shows a week. You know, I mean, that's exactly the kind of thing that people do, because they're playing themselves. And Bernadette Peters would be playing herself. What's interesting is Donna Murphy's playing Dolly Levi. And that's the kind of actress that Donna Murphy is. I'm not saying that's better. Some people like one, some the other. But she is less that kind of performer. And that's often a controversy. The biggest controversy I remember about this was in Fiddler on the Roof, which was a serious musical in a lot of people's eyes. And Zero Mostel found certain comic bits of business in Fiddler on the Roof. And 3 months into it, Zero Mostel was playing Zero Mostel. And the guys who were the producers did not like that. And when they made the movie, Zero Mostel was not in the movie. So there are different schools of thought on that.
But in any case, we would recommend Donna Murphy. Because here's the deal. I mean, we got tickets 2 days before.
Right.
Okay, so tickets are available to the shows that Donna Murphy is doing.
Yes.
If you go on the website, you will be able to find out which those are. Bette Midler is taking some breaks, some vacations. Donna Murphy's also doing it every Tuesday night. So this is a great opportunity. And other than Donna Murphy, it's the same cast. It's the same production.
And we should say,
and it's a terrific production.
The cast is great. Gavin Creel is great as a fellow named Cornelius Hackle. And
David Hyde Pierce.
David Hyde Pierce, you're right. He's extremely good.
I forget what you saw in the Tonys.
Oh, that's a good point. That's a good point.
Well, this is kind of, when you said farce, it kind of reminded me that this is sort of his genre. Because I feel like everything David Hyde Pierce does is a farce, like the Spamalot stuff. And, you know, he always does stuff like that where he's kind of doing that type of comedy.
But you saw, Sadie, the number they chose to do on the Tonys, and there's a long story we won't go into, I don't understand it. They chose to do a number on the Tonys where David Hyde Pierce comes out in front of the curtain and sings this song or tells the story about I had a penny in my pocket and it becomes a nickel, becomes a dime. And it's like an old vaudeville number. And it played like a lox on the Tonys. It wasn't interesting. It was almost like they were trying to keep people from going to the show. It didn't register. We saw it in person last night. It was extremely good.
It worked.
Yeah,
it worked.
Yeah.
It was great. You know, and it's really a fantastic night at the theater. And when we say go see it, we're not saying go see Bette Midler or go see Donna Murphy. We're saying go see it, and that means you're going to see Donna Murphy. Because you can't get tickets to see Bette Midler, although you can try. But yeah. You'll do fine.
And in a few months, you can try to get tickets to Bernadette Peters.
That's our prediction. That's exactly
right. Well, I wonder
right.
how long Bette's...
really going to do it?
Yeah, how long she's going to do it, and then if like Donna Murphy takes it for 5 months, and then Bernadette Peters does it afterwards, or what?
You could. You know, it takes a lot of stamina to do that show. We're not really coming down on Bette Midler because, you know, she happens to be 70 or whatever. You're talking about 8 shows a week. That's a challenge for anybody. I mean,
Bernadette Peters could start doing the, like, half the week.
Yeah, they could
split it with Donna Murphy.
Well, the history of this show, I'll tell you, when they did it in 64, there was a very formidable cast of successive stars. You had the initial with Carol Channing, but they went pretty quickly to Ethel Merman, who was originally supposed to be in it, and she wasn't available. And then you had a lot of other well-known, I think even Debbie Reynolds did, a lot of folks did it, just because it's that kind of star vehicle, breaking the mm-hmm. fourth wall mm-hmm. type vehicle. You just need a name of a musical actress of a certain age.
Yeah, but it's not one of those vanity productions where all the other parts are kind of phoned in. It really is a terrific
production. I tell you something, I don't want to get deeply into this, but I think Donna Murphy playing it down just a little bit and playing the character rather than playing an outsized personality almost brings the other cast in a little more.
It's possible, yeah.
Because they're playing off her in a different way.
But also, we were saying yesterday that she makes a lot of nods to Carol Channing throughout, which was nice, too, just kind of in the tone of her voice, which, I don't know, I doubt Bette is doing that.
Well, listen, Donna Murphy,
who knows?
She's selling it. It's not like she plays it like a conservative, serious actress. She's vamping it up to some degree. She's being funny.
Enough about Hello, Dolly. I think we've covered that.
All right, we have. So let's go to what struck me, at least, is the most interesting movie of the week, but we haven't seen it. But sometimes we have to talk about a movie before we see it to give you a chance to go see it, because otherwise we'll be gone. And that movie is a movie called Baby Driver, of which we can't know too much about because we haven't seen it, but there is a glowing review in the New York Times by Manola Dorgas. And I'll just say quite candidly, I don't always find the Manola Dorgas reviews that informative or interesting, but I have to give her due when she writes one that really registers. And this review has me wanting to see the movie and seems quite descriptive besides. I'll just read part of it. She almost seems to be channeling the 1970s Village Voice, but here's the way it reads. Again, Baby Driver, Manola Dorgas. This is how Baby rolls, with shifting gears, pumping feet, and thumping tunes. Baby drives hard, fast, tight, and seemingly oh so effortlessly, spinning wheels across pavement like a Russian Olympian on ice. Baby Driver is a pop pastiche par excellence, crammed with cubistic action, an encyclopedia of cinematic illusions, all basted in wall-to-wall tunage. The edits snap, the colors pop, the cinematography serves the performances and the story. Baby Driver is so good that you want it to be better. You want it to rocket out of the genre safe box into the cosmic beyond, where craft and technique transform into art.
And who's in this?
Well, there are a lot of people I know in it, and the star I don't know.
It's Ansel something?
I'll give you that name in a second. But the names that we do know, John Hamm, Kevin Spacey, and Jamie Foxx. The star of the movie is a fellow named Ansel Elgort, who I think is a newcomer who already is establishing sort of a cult of celebrity. I've already seen some articles about him. Maybe you have too, Sadie. I don't know.
I mean, he's not super newcomer. He's been around for...
Oh, that's right. He was in something else.
Like 2 or 3 years. He was in something with Cheyenne Woodley, I think.
Right.
And I'm blanking on it, but he's developing a reputation.
Well, look, that's a movie I know I want to see. Maybe I'll talk Tamsin into it. We'll see. And it's a pretty evocative review.
Okay.
All right. So let's go to the book reviews that we saw.
Book reviews. Okay. Starting with a new book about Jane Eyre called The Secret History of Jane Eyre by John Fordrescher. And I just mentioned this because my mother has been into the Brontes lately, so it's on my mind. And Mr. Fordrescher point is actually about the source of the story that she writes and why it's so compelling. The uncanny emotional authority, he says, of the novel comes in part from its refashioning of experiences that Bronte found dramatic and that her fiction processes as art. And so the idea is that, you know, it makes a great story because it's based in truth, her own personal experiences, and including fashioning this Rochester, this love of her life, as perhaps a sort of composite of three characters in her life, her father, Patrick, her brother, Branwell, and a French instructor that she had, a married French instructor that she had when she was in school. So this, you know, gives rise to a lot of interesting ideas about how to write and sources of information, and might be worth a read.
All right. I need to borrow that for a second. The book that caught my eye was one that's called The Physics of Everyday Things by James Kakalios, a professor of physics at the University of Minnesota. And look, one of the things that's a little off-putting, or at least gives me pause about...
Is the word physics.
No, with physics I'm totally comfortable
who
with.
Who cares about the physics
Sadie and
of
I
everyday things?
Are the physics,
you know,
people in our family.
I took physics and AP physics.
And I understand
and I
you did
very
quite
good
well.
About them.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right.
All right. Physics.
So this
is
a conversation for you and Sadie.
Me and Sadie. But and yet there are so many things in everyday life that it's just hard to fathom. And sometimes you just...
How can we possibly understand all this?
Well, here's what's interesting about this
book. What does he elucidate?
Okay, so he, without going into the explanations here, with Sadie and I will chew on over dinner, he makes various observations about what seems extremely imponderable high tech. For example, the way the clock in a smartphone works is very close to the familiar physics of a spring. Or that a GPS system locates you using old-fashioned trigonometry, just making corrections for Einsteinian relativity. And we all have to make that correction. But having said that, you know, trigonometry does sort of make sense.
You know, my mother just asked me if I understood relativity.
Yeah,
she was thinking about relativity.
Really?
92, she's thinking about relativity. And I said, well, I
thought you were going to say trigonometry, actually. You surprised me. Or that the light-emitting diodes, or LED, is nothing more than a solar cell run in reverse. Really? Well, for a solar cell, light goes in and current comes out. Well, for an LED, current goes in and light comes out.
All right. All right, so now it's all clear as mud.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, I could go on about this. What I think interesting about this is it doesn't run this to ground. I mean, if you try to explain any of these things really fully, you'd lose everybody. You'd certainly lose me. Maybe not Sadie.
But don't you think you have to read the whole book to get it to run aground?
This is a book review.
I know, that's what I'm saying.
I still don't think it runs aground. I think what the book sets out to do is explain things 70% of the way. And I'm all for that. I think there's something to having a sense of things without knowing it completely. And I think that's a pretty reasonable approach. And I think I'd benefit from that. So I might be looking into this.
Do you find yourself, is it reassuring that you might understand these things? Or is it better just to believe in them?
I can't believe in them unless I understand them.
Okay.
Okay. So you had something on Roebling, I think.
Yes. A book called Chief Engineer, reviewed in the Wall Street Journal. And the book is by Erica Wagner. And it talks about... John Roebling, and mainly I think his son Washington Roebling, who takes over the business after John dies tragically. And Roebling was the inventor of this iron rope that is used for suspension bridges, mm-hmm. and really was key in a lot of the great bridges we have in the United States, including, well, his first suspension bridge with this rope. And the rope, the wire rope, the iron rope was made on site, was to cross the Monongahela in Pittsburgh.
Tamsin smiles when she says that, as if
people know what we're talking about.
Exactly. That enhances our interest in the situation.
Who doesn't know about the Monongahela?
Yeah.
You know,
who can spell it, really?
Who's followed the pirates knows.
Right.
You know,
right.
But anyway.
Pittsburgh.
But, you know, and actually, he's pretty interesting. He, of course, designs with Washington, his son, and builds, Washington will have to finish it, the Brooklyn Bridge.
Mm-hmm.
And
Is that a suspension bridge?
It is.
Yes.
And he hurts his foot and dies as a result of that. Washington has to...
Where does the Verrazano fit into this? Because the Verrazano is the largest suspension bridge.
Well, now you're bringing in things I haven't prepared.
Right.
I mean, I know nothing about
I think that's a different technology.
Thank you very much. But here... Wait a minute.
But he's probably the brainchild behind...
Here's another Roebling bridge from much later that you would know, and that's the little pedestrian bridge that goes between Bull Island and the Black Bass Inn.
Right, and that's a walking bridge.
And it's a wonderful little bridge. It was built by the company after Roebling died later. The Roebling brothers also built a whole company town, Roebling, New Jersey.
Oh, really?
Yeah, which is defunct now. I mean, it's actually when the business was sold, they actually offered the properties that, it was like Pottersville in its wonderful life. But well run and humanely run, as I understand.
Makes it unlike Pottersville.
And the properties were offered to
the tenants.
To buy, etc., and so forth. And I was interested in this. I love bridges. I absolutely love bridges, and I love that pedestrian bridge. I love the Brooklyn Bridge.
I mean, you were just raving about the Gothels Bridge this morning.
The Gothels Bridge.
Well, that is quite a new
brand
design.
New bridge. Yeah. Extraordinary. Really beautiful.
Looks like
design.
That bridge in the UK that we go to, where the new Taft is.
Oh, the what do they call that? It was it has some funny name like Jiggling Bridge or something because it wiggled when you walk.
Not what you want to hear.
But also, another great bridge we saw, Sadie. Do you remember this outside of Orléans when we went on that bike trip, which was probably about 16 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
There was this great bridge right crossing the Loire, I think. In Orléans.
Sadie's nodding.
It was another kind of technology.
Yeah.
If you are a bridge lover, you might want to read this latest Roebling.
All right. So there was an article in the New York Times by coincidence or not, I can't tell, about letters they receive by famous people every once in a while. And I mentioned that, and I question whether it's a coincidence, because last week we read a letter from Jerry Seinfeld.
Letter to the editor.
A letter to the editor
of
the New York Times.
Piece.
Exactly
yeah.
right. Thank you.
And
for
it turned out to be by the comedian.
The comedian.
But it's
the Times
being,
pointed
not
out.
Not being funny.
Not being funny. Funny. Seriously mm-hmm. responding to David yeah. Brooks about what would enhance the likelihood that fathers would acquit themselves of their responsibilities. So there is an article in the Times. They mentioned several examples of celebrities writing in for various reasons. One, they mentioned Tennessee Williams, the playwright, wrote in taking issue with a Times article describing the playwright as boozing it up. Another in which they quote Agnes DeMille, the choreographer, wishing to clarify that her criticism of modern dancers meant those who performed the twist and the mashed potato, but not contemporaneous choreographers. But the one that really caught our interest was a letter that they included that had been written by Jackie Robinson, of course, the baseball player who broke the color barrier in the major leagues. And I'll just read the paragraph that they inserted. I think it speaks for yourself. Again, a letter from Jackie Robinson to the New York Times. I resented your comparing the status of the American Negro not with the status of other Americans by saying we are better off than non-whites in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. What you are saying is we never had it so good. It's high time that you understand that we are interested in comparing ourselves with the standards of our own country and not with the people's of other lands. And what's interesting, aside that being a very cogent thought, is that letter is written in 1967.
It's a great letter.
And it's a great letter. It's in a harsh rebuke to the New York Times, which we all think of as a very liberal newspaper. And yet, obviously, they wrote something in 1967 that elicited that response, which is kind of sobering in and of itself. So that was kind of interesting.
So my question there is, how many of the celebrity letters are actually the celebrities writing them, and how many of them are political things that some organization is telling a celebrity, hey, I know you support us, can we write this letter on your behalf? Or how much of it is a celebrity asking someone to write a letter that's more eloquent than they can give?
Well, okay, that's a fair question. I think it's a case-by-case basis. I think the Jerry Seinfeld letter read like something Jerry Seinfeld would write.
He's a writer. I mean, he's a comedian who writes his own jokes.
That's a good point.
Okay.
But, when someone like a Madonna or something like that writes into the New York Times. I don't think Madonna's writing her own letters.
And, you know, if you're going to tell me that Jackie Robinson may have had editorial help in putting together that letter, I could accept that. But it's still, I think it's still a significant letter. I mean, Jackie Robinson...
No, I think it's a very good letter. But I'm just wondering, there's a lot of stuff now that seems like an organic gesture, but then you find out that some even like an activist group got a hold of a celebrity that they know endorses them and like are using them kind of as a pawn.
I think that's fair. I think I should point out one thing though that we would remember from the time and you wouldn't have had the opportunity to say it, is that Jackie Robinson was an activist. And Jackie Robinson was more at the forefront of things in terms of making statements like that and being in the front of causes like that as opposed to being led along. But, you know, I think you make a fair point.
All right, back to failure.
Failure, yes.
We can't get enough of failure. And we just, we don't want to go into it in depth because we talk about failure every week. But
such an uplifting podcast.
Right. But we just want to note that now, as this article in the New York Times says, preoccupied in the 80s with success at any cost, the American business world now fetishizes failure thanks to technology experimentalist heroes like Steve Jobs. But while the idea of failing upward has become a badge of honor in the startup world, students are still focused on conventional metrics of achievement, campus administrators say. So we just want you to know there are courses now at Princeton, Harvard, Penn, Smith, Cornell, that students can take to help them learn how to deal with failure. Because these schools are so full of students that have had nothing but successes throughout their careers, and they get to college and suddenly they've failed an exam.
But also this screams a millennial problem to me, because that's kind of, you know, when you go back to childhood, now that they're giving like participation trophies for everything, they don't really let children fail at all.
Right. That's right.
So, so it's also kind of like a last 20 years issue of no one really knows how to fail.
I mean, you know, I have lots of failures, so I feel I could... Maybe that's one of my next adjunct
offerings. No. I think that Sadie has it right. That I think that it's been more of a gilded path for a lot of folks, for maybe entire generations. And you certainly do understand how people could get to an Ivy League school or even other schools and have felt that they never failed and they don't deal well with a setback because not everybody can be number one.
I understand that. I'm willing to help.
Okay.
Well, I just read a good book called Leaders Eat Last that goes through kind of the generation starting around the Depression and how that generation grew up... you know, with absolutely nothing in their pocket and really built, you know, fought the war and built the country from there. And then the next generation, the baby boomers, present company excluded perhaps, is the me generation of that's the first time people had disposable income. And then it kind of snowballs from there. Each generation afterwards, you know, has... their own issues based on the fact that now America does have a lot of disposable income and it just kind of like goes up and down of what the different issues are generation to generation.
So that's Eaters Lead Last. Okay.
I mean, the point there is...
You thought it was a good book.
Yeah. And the point there is when you're thinking about how you're leading people, you have to understand like what the generational issues are and what they see as incentives and what they see as... good things to have at work and bad things to have at work and, you know, what's going to motivate them.
That's a good point, yeah. All right, sounds interesting.
All right, so there's an article. We should come back to the July 4th theme. We don't want to ignore that. Independence Day, and that's coming on Tuesday. This is Sunday, and there's an article in the Times today called Happy Birthday America, Just One Small Suggestion. It's written by Stephen Fry, Stephen Fry being the English humorist, who some may remember from Jeeves and Wooster.
Yes, we've mentioned him before.
And we have. Well, yeah. Not everyone listens to every episode. So
really?
That's
well,
true.
Well, they should.
And I guess, what was he in? He was in the Oscar Wilde play. But he's in a lot of stuff. He's a funny guy.
Okay, yeah.
And
moving right along. What did he write?
So what he writes, he said, look, I won't read everything he has in here. It's just kind of a funny article. But he reviews the American Revolutionary War. He says, okay, fine, you guys won the American Revolutionary War. But we took the wrong lesson from it to some degree. He praises the United States. He loves the United States.
He says, you had a point.
He said that, first of all, you demonized King George III. And he was really a very nice man and a very nice king. And you got carried away with that. So much so that you got rid of monarchy or anything like it. And instead, you have a system where, and this is, he writes, the president was to be the highest citizen in the land, executive head of state, and commander in chief. That, I submit, was a mistake. And what he says, and what he contends, half seriously and half not seriously, is that the U.S. is missing something by not having something like a monarchy. And he cites as evidence the Netflix series The Crown. And he says
constitutional monarchy.
No, he doesn't go into, well, it could be
yes.
It could be like that, but it doesn't have to be a monarchy at all, frankly. Mm-hmm. But he says The Crown is instructive because you have the episodes in The Crown, and we talked about The Crown.
And we've all watched The Crown.
We've all watched
Sadie
The Crown.
Turned us on to
and
the
he
crown.
Says one of the things that The Crown is informative of is the role that the Queen plays. And even though the Queen is fairly young and not very well-versed in matters of state, that John Lithgow, as Winston Churchill, has to come in every week in an awkward exchange and bow to her and explain what the government's doing and why and sort of back out bowing. And he's quite discomforted by this and he has to explain himself. And what Fry says is that that's a fantastic thing. That's a fantastic thing.
She has
thing.
No powers. She has
no powers. Right. And yet the idea...
Her role is to advise and consent.
Right. The idea that someone has, that the head, in this case the prime minister, could be the president, has to stand in front of someone like a queen or someone in that position and explain themselves while that person says things like tut, 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 clucks their tongue, says, gee, when we dealt with this 20 years ago, it seemed to work out a little more smoothly, is all to the good. And as he describes it, again, this is Stephen Fry, put your mind the picture of any president, including the current president, being forced to bow himself backward out of the presence of a figure like this. Wouldn't that just beat the band and the fireworks too? Happy 4th of July. He actually proposes that instead of having a monarchy, that we have a reality show in which we pick someone who's gonna play this role. He says it's really a lottery. The monarchy's a lottery too. And he says America's mm-hmm. very good at reality shows. We'll pick someone. They'll be Uncle Sam, they'll be Aunt Samantha.
But the idea would be that the president has to explain himself
to someone
articulate
who
what is going on.
Exactly, yeah. Who represents the country in that odd way. So anyway, that's his proposal, and there's something to it.
Okay.
We're going to go to... Did you have your... should we go to sports, or do you have something before that?
No, I have something before that. I just want to mention there was a cute article in the New York Times this week about saving baby kangaroos.
Really?
Yes, it's about Joey orphanages, Sadie. And what happens in Australia is that on the highways, like, kangaroos will get hit by cars and killed, but there may still be a living little baby in the pouch. And so it was a nice story about the people who rescue them. And there are, you know, various places where you can take the baby, and they are hung in a pouch, in one case actually under their TV set, and they're fed, and it's a very sweet little story. And there's a cute video of the baby, the Joey, the baby kangaroo, crawling into the man-made pouch and snuggling up.
Well, so that resonates with me because I don't know if you remember, but I have tried to hatch baby birds myself by sitting on them.
Yeah, as I remember, that wasn't the most successful
venture. Not successful, but logically sound.
Yes.
Logically sound. I think there was a bluebird egg in the field, and I said, you know what, this needs to be hatched. I need to sit on it.
This was some time ago, just so we're clear.
Yes.
I mean, like a few years ago.
Yeah, a few years ago.
And so then I want to talk about...
Let me start with, when we go to sports, I think we'll start with the basketball, and then we'll go to the swimming. Okay?
Okay.
All right. So There's a league, I just want to make sure you're aware of. There's a new basketball league. And sometimes I feel like I'm not doing my job.
Do we need another basketball league?
Well, there's no question we need.
What is this basketball league?
Okay, this is a 3-on-3 league. Sadie's going to be drawn into this.
Okay, 3-on-3.
Say, be honest, did you even know about this?
No.
Okay, there you go. 3-on-3.
Late-breaking news.
Sadie knows that 3-on-3 is half-court basketball, or you can play it full-court. And then if any of the... Let's not go into the details of the rules, but it is 3-on-3. And they actually, it's a new pro league. The players are former NBA players. Guys are a little bit older.
Is this what guys play in the parks in New York?
Yeah,
and stuff?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's to recreate the intensity and the excitement and the fun of that.
It's to get jobs to people who are out of basketball. That's really what it's about. And yet it's attracted some attention. It's called the Big Three. And they had 15,000 fans at the Barclays Center in Brooklyn to see the opening set of games. And the Times describes the situation for us, including what's good and what's bad. What's good is that it's kind of novel, the 3-on-3 half court. Moves kind of quickly. Number two, it's very physical. And Sadie will back me up that 3-on-3 half-court basketball can be extremely physical because you're crammed into a smaller space.
Well, half-court basketball with you is extremely physical.
Exactly. I'm going to be in this league. That's where this is all going. That they have some star players in the league, which adds some juice. That they have some star coaches who lend their names to the league and adds more juice. So it's kind of fun. What the problems with the league is that there are a lot of people who aren't star players. It's a little less exciting to watch them play. They don't have a live TV contract. It's on ESPN, but it's on tape. That's a drawback. But the biggest drawback, of course, is guess what? The players get hurt. It turns out that when you get 40 or 50-year-old guys playing intensely 3-on-3 basketball, they play for 15 minutes, and they go, geez, my leg. And they're out of the game. So that's been a huge problem.
So how long are the games?
They go on actually for some length. They have first reach 50, 2 points. They actually have some innovations. They have a 4-point shot in addition to a 3-point shot. It can take quite a while. But Gary Payton, one of the coaches, sums it up when he says, quote, your body don't recover like when you were 19. And I think there's something to that. I think that's going to be the biggest challenge for the league. But we'll see. We'll see if they catch on.
So, of course, when you mention the Big Three,
yeah.
I immediately think of Leonardo, Raphael, and Michelangelo.
That's right.
And I'm imagining them right now on the court together.
And when you said Leonardo, Raphael, and Michelangelo, I'm thinking, what about Donatello? Because they're the whole Ninja Turtle group.
But that would be four.
Yeah.
See, that's what makes this podcast work. We all bring our own perspectives to the situation. And we think we're talking to each other, but we all have in our heads something completely different.
But enough about land sports.
Yes, go ahead.
There was a nice article in the Times about a couple of swimmers who across... the years, centuries, whatever, have kind of developed a relationship. And that would be a relationship between Katie Ledecky and...
Ledecky.
And Chris Olmstead. And Chris Olmstead, Katie's about 20 years old, and Chris Olmstead is 73. And she was the first woman to break the 5-minute mark in the 400 freestyle. And
Ledecky.
The 500.
In the 500.
Oh, you
it know. Says 400
okay.
in the New York Times. I mean,
well, maybe that was something.
But, and then Ledecky, it says, broke the 4-minute mark.
Yeah.
But anyway.
That makes sense.
That makes sense, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So this was in the late 50s that Olmstead was swimming. Anyway, they became acquainted. Olmstead contacted her through email, contacted Ledecky through email, and they developed a relationship.
Well, they were both teenage phenoms, I guess.
Right, yeah. Right. Then they both went to Stanford.
Yeah.
And so they have a lot of commonalities. But it's just funny to hear the description of Olmstead's swimming and her experiences at that time. Mm-hmm. For instance, when she... you know, when she was out of the Olympics, she then went to Stanford. Mm-hmm. When she went to Stanford in the early 60s, Stanford did not have a women's swimming team.
Well, because that was pre-Title IX.
And women were not even allowed in the men's pool. And so that was it. That was the end of her swimming career.
Why should men and women swim in the same pool?
Well, there are many reasons they should
question.
Question we're still looking for an answer for that.
Here's the other thing. And Ledecky says she actually has watched YouTube clips of Olmsted swimming in the 50s in some of her races without a cap, without goggles, without flip turns. And so it's just funny to think how different swimming was at that time. And in fact, I was swimming on the local team in the early 60s. And there was only, nobody on our team could do a flip turn. And there was only like one or two guys in the league in Maryland who could do a flip turn. Right. And I, to this day, I can't do a flip turn, but I do a fair amount of swimming. Now, my swimming is not primo, but there's a solution to that. And that would be in the Wall Street Journal this weekend, there was an article about how to up your game in various water sports. And it turns out there's a program called Total Immersion.
Oh, no, I saw that. And, I'm totally into that.
And they have camps. They have a methodology that really makes swimming look incredibly relaxing,
right.
almost lazy, that's, they say.
I'm
but it's much more efficient. And guess what?
Right.
They actually have a camp. They have a studio for this
right.
in New Paltz,
oh, really?
New York.
Really?
So we could go there. New Paltz is one of our favorite places.
You're
that's where Mohonk Mountain House is.
With me until you said we. But yeah, I thought you would go and then explain it to me.
All right. Well, we could take a vote over who needs more work.
No,
on their
I haven't looked at it because I need to calm down my swimming. You know, I'm all over the place. I am. I'll tell you right now. I am.
I think these people could help you.
I'm the weak swimmer. Sadie's a super swimmer.
Some might
swimmer.
Say you go backwards when you swim.
Yeah, exactly.
That's
the,
right.
The children
it
give me a hard
a
time
funny.
About swimming.
That's why I brought you a very bright bathing suit so that, like, you know, if there's distress.
Yeah.
We could see you in the
we could
ocean.
Find you.
Yeah.
I am in this family of five, the so-called non-swimmer, and yet I'm not that bad a swimmer. And number two, in my family growing up, I was a swimmer.
You are a super swimmer in your family.
Exactly. So it's like Gulliver's Travels. It's very confusing for me. But I look forward to it.
I'm
going to
work on understanding that, but okay.
Well, yeah, you'll get it. All right, so the final story we have, but it is, again, sports-oriented and more in terms of the retirement angle of things, has to do with Jim Boughton, who is suffering from a stroke and even some dementia-related diseases. That may have been caused by
well,
the stroke.
He had a couple of strokes. He had a small stroke and
right.
then a bigger stroke, and brain damage was caused.
And the disease is called cerebral amyloid angiopathy, which has been linked to dementia. And it leaves him unable to communicate reliably, although he has had relearned some of his skills.
He's had a lot of therapy.
In terms of writing
yeah.
and speaking.
Yeah.
And his wife is a therapist in this area, so that helps in terms of personal communication.
I will.
But he also has holes in his memory. He's mentally diminished, and perhaps he's going to be diminished some more. And that's what prompts the article. But you're right. I should explain who he is. So Jim Boughton was a pitcher for the Yankees in the 1960s. I remember watching him in the World Series. He's a very interesting guy because he was good enough to win 20 games one year, which is the mark of a very successful pitcher. But not great. And after his career wound down relatively early, when he was about 30 or something like that, he wrote a book called The Ball Four, which was released in 1970, which described what went on in the clubhouse on the
benches. So this is his memoir.
It was a memoir of his time with the Yankees,
mm-hmm.
but it was interpreted very much as a tell-all book.
Uh-huh.
And because there was no window into that before that. No one had any idea. Sports writing was a little more superficial. And he was laying bare a lot of things that were somewhat questionable, let's say, politically
uh-huh.
incorrect.
Did you read this
it.
Book?
Oh, yes. Oh,
yeah.
yes. Anybody.
You still have this book? Is there like?
Yes.
Is there a copy of
yes,
a paperback
there is,
copy
in Long Island, yes.
at 24 Glen Road?
There is.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
it was considered pretty racy at the time. And uh-huh. it might still be considered pretty racy in some respects. But what was highly controversial about it was the sort of the thinking then was what went on in the locker room stayed in the locker room. And you didn't expose this. And it turns out what went on in the locker room was a lot of drinking, a lot of womanizing, a lot of not being prepared to play the next day, a lot of pill popping. And he was writing about this because he said, well, gee, why not have a window into that? And the guys in the league, a lot of them went crazy.
Really?
And it was a tremendous negative reaction to him.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, I can understand that
yeah.
because you're hanging out with people, they have no idea that you're going to be writing about them years later. The book was a bestseller.
Yeah.
And he had to add another chapter of Jim Bouton, and then he had a comeback. Because he decided that he was getting back in the league by throwing a knuckleball, which sometimes people do. They lose their fastball and they try to develop a trick pitch, which was a knuckleball. And he had success coming back, but he was sort of a pariah at the same time. So he's a pitcher. He was a writer. But now what's odd about the article is it begins with an observation of him pitching. In other words, even now with him mentally diminished, he can still pitch. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he pitches as someone who's now, you know, in his 60s. He doesn't pitch like he pitched when he was in his 20s. But that part of him is not diminished, at least in terms of intellectual capacity. He can do everything he can. He's got all the muscle memory to pitch. He just can't speak well. He doesn't memorize well. And, in fact, those skills are diminishing. So, again, his wife happens to be a therapist. And we'll just end with a quote in the Times. It's kind of interesting, summing up the situation. And here's what the Times says. It says, in her work with brain-damaged children, Kerman, who was his wife, said her boss would tell her to think about what remains, not what is lost. It is a lesson she applies now. Her husband can still make her laugh, still make her think. He has taken up painting again, and he can still pitch. And here's the quote. You need to learn that the person is still that person, and you have to focus more on what he can do rather than what he can't do, she said, and then you adjust. Well, that's all we have this week from Tams and Dan Read the Paper. Special guest, of course, Sadie Abuhoff, and we'll be back next week.
Okay, thank you.